So, imagine a financial advisor who is just exceptionally good at their job.
Okay.
Like, their clients are making money, the paperwork is flawless, and they have a completely clean compliance record.
Right.
But then, on a Saturday afternoon, totally off the clock, this advisor goes to a local diner and gets caught stealing like 500 packets of ketchup.
Wow. Ketchup.
Yeah, just ketchup, not cash from the register or anything. A few weeks later, the regulatory hammer comes down, and this advisor is permanently barred from the securities industry, like career over ketchup.
That is, I mean, it sounds crazy, but it happens.
Exactly. And today
Huh.
we're unpacking a regulatory landscape where the rules aren't just about, math or margin requirements. They are about the absolute unrelenting enforcement of human ethics.
Yeah, you really can't put a neat formula on human behavior.
Right. But before we dive into the murky waters of financial morality, this deep dive is actually brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're prepping for the Series 24, trying to memorize all these abstract rules, they have a full course that, actually adapts to how you learn.
It's a lifesaver, honestly.
Yeah, it's great. We're talking adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real test. You can check them out at certfuel.com. Anyway, back to our mission today. We are mastering the conduct of associated persons.
Which is usually the section that trips people up the most.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about like net capital requirements, it's binary. The formula works or it doesn't.
Right.
But with conduct rules, we're trying to master a system designed by FINRA and the SEC to basically legislate integrity. And for anyone listening out there, whether you're studying or walking the dog or just trying to understand how Wall Street is policed, our goal today is to figure out the why behind these rules.
Yeah, the why is everything.
I don't just want to memorize that stealing ketchup gets you fired. I mean, I want to understand the regulatory mechanism that allows that.
Well, if we establish the underlying philosophy first, then all the specific numbers and rules just become, logical extensions rather than random facts you have to memorize.
Right.
And every single regulation we're going to cover today basically orbits one massive gravitational center, which is the anti-fraud principle.
Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal.
Exactly. Because regulators know they just can't predict every single new creative way a broker might try to game the system. So they built a framework that relies on these really broad ethical nets combined with like hyper-specific federal teeth.
Okay, so let's look at the broadest net first. FINRA's core standard.
Yeah, the catch-all.
Right. They require all registered reps to observe high standards of commercial honor and just and equitable principles of trade, which, I mean, honestly, that sounds like something written on a medieval scroll. What does commercial honor actually mean in a modern digital market?
Well, it means exactly what it needs to mean in the moment.
Oh, so it's vague on purpose.
Oh, yeah, that vague phrasing is highly intentional. It acts as FINRA's ultimate catch-all rule because human ingenuity, especially when it comes to being shady, is always going to outpace a regulator's ability to write specific rules.
That makes sense.
So if a representative does something incredibly dishonest, but no specific technical rule explicitly forbids it, yet FINRA just deploys the commercial honor standard.
Which brings us back to my diner scenario,
Yeah.
because I have to push back on this a little bit.
Sure.
Stripping someone's federal licensing over a petty theft at a restaurant seems like, I don't know, massive regulatory overreach. Like, where's the jurisdiction there?
So the jurisdiction lies in this concept of a nexus of integrity.
A nexus of integrity.
Yeah. FINRA's stance is that a person's character cannot be compartmentalized. You don't have like a Saturday ethics profile and a Monday morning profile.
Okay.
If you demonstrate a fundamental willingness to commit a dishonest act like stealing 500 ketchup packets or tax fraud or lying on a mortgage application, you've proven a defect in your integrity.
So if you'll cheat a diner, you'll cheat a retail investor.
Exactly. Therefore, your conduct is inconsistent with just and equitable principles of trade, regardless of where it actually happened.
Wow. Okay. Let's turn this outward. I want everyone listening to think through this next scenario. I'm actually going to pause after I ask it so you can think.
Good idea.
Let's say a registered rep submits their official Form U-4 paperwork, right?
Hi.
But they intentionally hide a personal bankruptcy from a few years ago.
Okay.
Now they get hired, they trade beautifully, and absolutely zero customers lose money. No client is harmed in any way by this lie. Does FINRA still have grounds for a commercial honor violation? Pause.
They do. And customer harm is absolutely not a prerequisite.
See, this is exactly where the exam tries to set a trap for you.
Oh yeah, they love this one.
They will feed you this long, detailed scenario about a broker doing something deceptive, mm-hmm. but they'll explicitly emphasize that, you know, the client's portfolio grew by 20% or no funds were ever at risk. They're trying to trigger that instinct we all have that says, you know, no harm, no foul.
It's a classic misdirection. The act of lying on an official regulatory document is inherently a breach of commercial honor. The violation is the lie itself, not the financial outcome of the lie.
Right.
Furthermore, a commercial honor charge doesn't even need to be attached to a specific rule break. It can just be a standalone charge.
So they can just hit you with that and nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, often FINRA will stack it, say, charging a rep for running an illegal side business, and then stacking a commercial honor violation on top for the deception involved in hiding it. But it is entirely capable of standing on its own.
Okay, so that's the self-regulatory side. But let's look at the federal side, because the SEC has its own anti-fraud rule, Rule 10b-5. And this one isn't just about losing your license.
No, this one involves prison time.
Right, so break that down for us.
So Rule 10b-5 is the bedrock anti-fraud provision of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And the most critical mechanical difference here is jurisdiction. FINRA's rules apply to FINRA members, so broker-dealers and their registered reps. But the SEC's anti-fraud rule applies to literally anyone.
Wait, anyone? Meaning like an issuer, a hedge fund manager, or just some random guy day trading meme stocks in his basement?
Yes. Anyone who employs a scheme to defraud, makes an untrue statement of a material fact, or omits a material fact in connection with the purchase or sale of a security.
Wow.
And the penalties for willful violations of the Exchange Act are severe. Which brings us to a highly testable set of thresholds.
Oh, I know this one. The 5-20-25 rule. I use this memory aid all the time. Listeners, you need to lock these three numbers down. 5-20-25.
Yep.
Let's break the mechanics of those down.
So the 5 represents the maximum fine for an individual, which is $5 million.
Okay.
The 20 represents the maximum prison sentence for an individual, 20 years.
Right.
And the 25 is the maximum fine for a corporate entity, $25 million.
Okay. But there's a massive legal loophole here regarding the word willful, right?
Right, it is.
Let's say I'm a rep. I execute a complex option strategy. I intended to do the trades, but I completely misunderstood a highly obscure SEC rule.
Okay.
I had no idea I was breaking the law.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting in front of the judge pleading total ignorance. What actually happens?
Well, you might avoid the orange jumpsuit, but your bank account is still getting drained.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the Exchange Act states that lack of knowledge of a rule is a valid defense against imprisonment.
Oh, okay.
If you can definitively prove you had no knowledge the rule existed, they cannot sentence you to the 20 years. However, ignorance is not a defense against the financial penalty. You can still be hit with the full $5 million fine.
So ignorance keeps you out of a cell, but it doesn't protect your wallet. That is a brilliant distinction.
It really is.
Okay, let's pivot from the general philosophy of fraud into the mechanics of handling the single most sensitive thing in the industry, which is the customer's cash.
Oh, yeah.
And to explore this, we are going to introduce our first recurring hypothetical character.
Oh.
Listeners, I want you to picture Slippery Steve.
Slippery Steve, I love it.
Steve is a slick registered rep with a remarkable talent for making terrible compliance decisions.
Sounds like a lot of guys I know.
Right. So it's a Friday afternoon. Steve has a weekend trip to Vegas planned, but his checking account is completely empty. He notices that one of his wealthy clients has $5,000 just sitting in uninvested cash in their brokerage account.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Steve decides to temporarily transfer that $5,000 into his own account just for the weekend. He already has his end-of-month bonus check arriving on Monday, and he fully, like 100%, intends to put the client's money back on Monday morning before anyone even logs in.
Well, Steve has just committed an egregious violation known as improper use.
Okay.
And the mechanism the regulators look at here is unauthorized control, not ultimate intent.
Wait, even if he genuinely meant to put it back? Like, what if he literally wrote the repayment check on Friday and left it on his desk to deposit Monday?
It does not matter. The violation occurs the millisecond the funds are moved for personal use. Yes. Because commingling client funds with firm or personal funds creates immediate systemic risk. Think about it. What if Steve goes to Vegas, loses the money, and then his bonus check bounces?
The client's cash is just gone.
Exactly. Intent to repay is totally irrelevant. The money is not his. This is a severe commercial honor violation, and it will absolutely end his career.
Okay, so by some miracle, Steve's Vegas trip gets canceled, he doesn't take the money, and he keeps his job.
Lucky Steve.
Very lucky. But the next week, Steve is sitting with a very nervous client who is terrified of a market correction. Steve really wants to close a big trade, so he leans across the desk and says, "Look, I guarantee you cannot lose money on this position. If the stock drops, I will personally cover the difference and make you whole."
Yeah, Steve just violated the absolute prohibition against guarantees against loss. A registered representative can never, under any circumstances, guarantee a customer against market loss.
Let me throw another trap at you, though. What if the stock skyrockets?
Yep.
The trade makes a 50% profit. The client is ecstatic. No loss ever materialized, so Steve never actually had to cover anything. Does that change it?
No. The outcome of the trade is a ghost. It doesn't matter. The regulatory breach happened the exact second the words, "I guarantee," left Steve's mouth.
Wow.
Guaranteeing against loss misrepresents the fundamental nature of securities markets, which inherently carry risk. By removing that perception of risk, Steve is acting deceptively.
I want to draw a direct comparison here because this is a classic spot for confusion on the exam.
Definitely.
We just established that a human rep can never make a front-end promise to cover a loss. But what happens if the corporate firm itself makes a mistake? Let's say Steve submits an order to buy 100 shares, but the firm's trading desk accidentally buys 10,000 shares.
Oh boy.
Yeah, the stock tanks and the client's account is completely decimated.
Yeah.
Can the firm reimburse the client then?
Yes, they can. But look at the mechanical difference there. Steve made a prohibited front-end guarantee against market risk. The firm, in your scenario, is executing a back-end settlement for a bona fide operational error.
Ah.
Fixing a broken operational pipe after the fact is entirely legal and honestly required. But promising that the market itself will never harm the client is illegal.
Okay, so pre-trade promise versus post-trade fix. That makes total sense.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to throw a pattern interrupt in here. If you've been zoning out looking at the trees on your walk, snap back to this next concept because it is universally tested from multiple angles.
Pay attention to this one.
We are talking about borrowing from or lending to customers.
Yes. This is a highly restricted area because the power dynamic between a broker and a client makes loans inherently dangerous. The baseline rule is just a blanket prohibition. No borrowing, no lending, period.
Okay.
However, FINRA provides 5 specific exceptions. But before we get to those exceptions, we have to talk about the master key that unlocks them.
The written supervisory procedures, right?
Yeah.
The WSPs.
Exactly. The WSPs are the firm's internal rulebook. All 5 FINRA exceptions only exist in reality if the firm's WSPs explicitly permit them.
So if a firm just doesn't want the headache.
If a broker-dealer decides they want zero liability and their WSPs say no borrowing or lending under any circumstances, then FINRA's exceptions are dead in the water for that firm. A firm can always be stricter than FINRA, they just can't be more lenient.
Got it. Okay, assuming the firm's WSPs do allow it, let's list the 5 exceptions.
Number 1, the customer is an immediate family member. Number 2, the customer is a financial institution regularly engaged in the business of lending.
Like a commercial bank.
Yeah, exactly. Like a normal bank. Number 3, both the rep and the customer are registered persons at the exact same firm.
Okay.
Number 4, there is a personal relationship outside the broker-customer relationship. And number 5, there is a business relationship outside the brokerage context.
I want to zoom in on that first one, immediate family, because FINRA modernized this definition recently to reflect how actual households look today. It's no longer just blood relatives and spouses.
Right. They replaced husband or wife with spouse or domestic partner, and they explicitly looped in step and adoptive relationships. So stepchildren, adopted grandparents, they all qualify. But the real mechanism to watch out for is the catch-all clause at the very end of the family list.
Which is?
Any other person.
Oh, okay. This is a massive exam trap.
Uh-huh.
So let's bring Slippery Steak back.
Let's do it.
Steve has a roommate who sleeps on his couch, plays video games all day, and pays absolutely zero rent. The roommate has an inheritance sitting in a brokerage account that Steve manages. Steve wants to borrow 10 grand from the roommate. Does the roommate count as immediate family under the catch-all?
So to qualify under the any other person catch-all, FINRA requires 2 specific conditions to be met simultaneously.
Okay.
First, the person must reside in the same household as the registered rep. Second, the registered rep must financially support that person to a material extent.
Well, they live in the same apartment, and Steve pays all the rent and buys all the groceries because the roommate refuses to get a job.
Then mechanically, yes, the roommate fits the definition because Steve is providing material financial support to someone in his household.
Wow.
But remember the master key? Even though it qualifies under Finar's family exception, Steve still has to follow whatever his firm's WSPs dictate regarding notification or approval.
Right, right. The firm always gets the final say. Let's look at one more thing Steve wants to do with client money. He finds a client who loves day trading, and Steve says, hey, let's open a joint account together. We'll pool our money and go 50-50 on the profits. This is known as sharing in customer accounts. What are the regulatory hurdles here?
There are two massive hurdles. First, before a single dollar is deposited, Steve must obtain prior written authorization from both his firm and the customer.
Okay.
Second, and this is where the math comes in, Steve must contribute to the account proportionately.
Meaning, if he wants 50% of the upside, he has to put up 50% of the capital. He can't put in $1,000, have the client put in $99,000, and still take half the profits.
Exactly. FineRO forces the rep to have proportionate skin in the game. You share the profits and the losses in exact correlation to your capital contribution. However, there is one major exception to the proportionality math.
Let me guess, immediate family again.
Correct. If Steve is opening this joint account with his spouse, the proportionality rule is waived. They can fund the account however they see fit.
Oh, nice.
But UT, and this is a critical distinction that trips up a lot of people,
yeah,
the family exception does not waive the requirement for the firm's prior written approval.
Okay.
The firm still has to know about it and authorize it in writing.
That makes perfect sense. The firm always needs visibility. Okay, let's shift gears. Saif has finally realized that touching customer money is a compliance minefield. So he decides to make money on the side. He's going off the clock. This introduces the concept of selling away.
Yeah, this is a massive area of regulatory focus because side hustles pull a rep's attention and potentially create massive liability for the broker-dealer. We separate these into two distinct buckets: outside business activities, or OBAs, and private securities transactions, or PSTs.
Let's tackle OBAs first. Steve decides to do some marketing consulting for a local tech startup on the weekends. What is his required action?
He must provide prior written notice to his firm. Not approval, just notice.
Just notice, okay.
Once the firm receives that notice, their compliance department has to evaluate the activity based on two primary risk factors: interference and attribution risk.
Interference is obvious. Like, is Steve going to be so exhausted from his consulting gig that he starts making errors in his day job? But let's define attribution risk.
Attribution risk is the danger of a customer blurring the lines between Steve's side hustle and the broker-dealer's official business.
Ah, I see.
If Steve uses his firm-issued laptop or takes consulting meetings in the firm's conference room, a client might assume the broker-dealer is endorsing or supervising this tech startup. And if the startup goes bankrupt, the client might sue the broker-dealer, claiming they thought it was an approved investment.
Let me throw an exam chap in here. Does an OBA only trigger if Steve is getting a W-2 paycheck? Or cash. What if the startup has no money, so they just offer him a 5% equity stake in exchange for his marketing advice?
The trigger mechanism for the OBA rule is a reasonable expectation of compensation. Equity is absolutely compensation.
Okay.
The moment he agrees to work for that equity, the OBA rule is triggered and prior written notice is required.
And what if, like a year later, the startup gets massive funding and they upgrade Steve from a weekend consultant to a full-blown board member with a six-figure retainer? He already gave notice a year ago. Is he in the clear?
No, not at all. Material changes to the scope or compensation of an OBA require updated written notice. The firm evaluated the risk based on him being a weekend consultant. Being a board member carries vastly different liabilities.
Okay, so that is OBA, a business activity. Let's look at the second bucket. What if Steve's side hustle involves actual investments? Let's say Steve starts selling shares of his buddy's private startup to his country club friends.
Now, he has crossed the line from an OBA into a private securities transaction, a PST.
Okay.
This is the classic definition of selling away from the firm. And how the firm must handle this depends entirely on one mechanical switch: selling compensation.
I want to break this down really clearly. Listeners, picture a fork in the road. On the left side, we have a PST with selling compensation. On the right side, we have a PST without selling compensation. Let's walk down the left side first. Steve is getting a 10% commission for every share of the startup he sells.
If there is selling compensation, the regulatory burden skyrockets. Steve must provide detailed prior written notice. Then the firm must explicitly approve or disapprove the transaction in writing.
Yeah, they have to formally approve it.
Yes. And if they approve it, it ceases to be a side hustle. The firm must record the transaction on their own books and supervise Steve's conduct as if it were a trade executed through the firm's own systems.
Wait, so the firm basically adopts the transaction and all the liability that comes with it?
Exactly. Because Steve is profiting from selling a security, the regulator's logic is follow the money. If the rep is getting paid to move securities, the supervising firm must take responsibility for it to protect the public.
Okay, let's walk down the right side of the fork. A PST without selling compensation. Steve is just helping his buddy raise capital for free. He gets nothing.
Steve still must provide prior written notice. But the firm's mechanical response changes. They are not required to formally approve it, and they don't have to take it onto their books.
Okay.
They simply provide prompt written acknowledgement that they received Steve's notice. They can impose conditions if they want, but the liability doesn't automatically attach to the firm in the same way.
But let me ask you about the definition of selling compensation. Because Steve might go to compliance and say, look, my buddy isn't giving me any cash commissions. But what Steve leaves out is that his buddy is reimbursing all of his travel expenses to meet these investors and threw in some stock warrants as a thank you.
The regulators interpret selling compensation extremely broadly. Cash commissions, finder's fees, stock warrants, equity, expense reimbursements. If Steve is receiving any form of economic value for facilitating that transaction, he is on the left side of the fork.
Uh-huh.
He needs written approval and the firm must put it on their books.
Let's look at one final off-the-clock scenario for Steve, personal trading.
Hmm.
Steve is a registered rep, but he wants to day trade highly volatile meme stocks. He knows his own firm's compliance department will scrutinize every trade, so he goes to a completely different bank across town and opens a retail brokerage account there. What are the rules?
Before that account can be opened, Steve needs prior written consent from his employer firm. Furthermore, he is required to notify the executing firm, the new bank, in writing about his employment status as a registered rep.
Direct question for the listener. Think about this carefully. What if Steve doesn't open the account in his own name? What if he is just listed as a beneficiary on a massive trust account that his mother manages? Or what if it's a joint checking and brokerage account with his spouse? Does that trigger the notification rules? Pause.
Yes, it triggers the rule entirely. The mechanism FINRA uses here is beneficial interest.
Beneficial interest.
Yeah. It doesn't matter whose name is at the top of the statement. If Steve has a beneficial interest, which automatically includes spousal accounts, joint accounts, and trust accounts where he is a beneficiary or has discretion, he must get prior written consent.
And what if the timeline is flipped? What if Steve had this account at the other bank for 5 years, and then he passes his exams and gets hired as a registered rep at his new firm?
The rules provide a strict grandfather window. If he held the account prior to association, he has exactly 30 calendar days from his date of hire to obtain his new employer's written consent and to notify the executing firm.
Okay.
If he hits day 31 without that paperwork, he's in violation.
30 calendar days. Lock that number in. All right. We are leaving the retail world of Slippery Steve, and we are taking the elevator up to the executive floor.
The corporate vault.
The corporate vault. This is where we get into fiduciary duty and insider trading, and the risk profile completely changes.
Yeah, at the retail level, the risk is about reps stealing cash or lying about risk. At the institutional level, the currency isn't hash, it's information.
To illustrate this, let's introduce our second character, Fiona the fiduciary.
Fiona?
Fiona works for a large financial firm that acts as a transfer agent for a massive publicly traded company. Because she is the transfer agent, Fiona holds the absolute holy grail of corporate data, the issuer's complete shareholder list.
Powerful stuff.
She knows every name, every address, and exactly how many shares they own. Now, the retail brokers who work in the same building as Fiona are drooling over this data. They want Fiona to hand over the list so they can cold call these wealthy shareholders and pitch them completely unrelated mutual funds.
Which introduces the fiduciary duty rule. When a firm obtains ownership information in a fiduciary capacity, like acting as a transfer agent, a paying agent, or a trustee, they are strictly prohibited from using that information to solicit retail purchases or sales.
It's a use-based test, isn't it? Because Fiona didn't steal the list. She acquired it completely legally as part of her job.
Exactly. Acquiring the data is legal and necessary. The violation is using it for retail solicitation. The firm has to maintain a strict separation between its fiduciary hat and its retail broker hat. Passing that list across the building is a massive breach of trust.
Is there any exception? What if the issuer company itself wants Fiona to contact the shareholders?
That is the one and only exception. Fiona can solicit those shareholders at the request and on behalf of the issuer. For example, if the issuer is running a proxy vote or executing a tender offer, and they instruct Fiona, acting as their agent, to contact the shareholders to facilitate that specific corporate action, it is perfectly legal. She is acting for the principal, not for her firm's retail gain.
Got it. Let's talk about the big one. Material non-public information, or MNPI. Insider trading. There is a huge misconception about what actually constitutes insider trading in a court of law. If I know a massive corporate secret and I place a trade, do the regulators have to prove that the secret actually motivated me to make the trade?
No. And this is a crucial evolution in securities law. The legal standard used to be heavily debated, but the SEC clarified it. The standard is trading on the basis of MNPI.
Okay.
And they define on the basis of to simply mean that the trader was aware of the information at the time of the trade. Awareness alone is sufficient. They do not have to prove the information motivated you, because proving the inner psychological motivation of a trader in court is basically impossible.
But wait, if you are a C-suite executive, you are perpetually aware of your company's secrets. You know the unreleased earnings, the pending lawsuits, the R&D failures. Under the awareness standard, how can a CEO ever legally sell their own stock to, say, buy a house or pay for their kids' college?
They rely on an affirmative defense mechanism known as a prearranged trading plan, specifically a 10b5-1 plan.
Okay.
This is a binding written contract that the executive establishes before they become aware of any specific actionable MNPI. The contract dictates the exact amount, price, and date of future trades, or it hands total discretionary control over to a third-party broker. The executive sets it up when their hands are clean, and the trades execute automatically later.
But the SEC recently realized executives were exploiting loopholes in these plans, right? Setting them up and then immediately trading.
Yes. The SEC heavily tightened the rules to prevent abuse. They instituted strict cooling-off periods. Now, when a director or officer adopts a 10b5-1 plan, they cannot trade the next day. They must wait the longer of 90 days or 2 business days after the disclosure of the issuer's financial earnings. And that maximum wait period is capped at 120 days.
The longer of 90 days or 2 business days after earnings, that is a vital time frame to understand. Let me throw a wrench into this, though. What if our CEO sets up a perfect plan, waits the required 90 days, and the plan is running smoothly? But then she learns a massive, unexpected secret the company is being acquired next week for double its current valuation. Mm. She panics, calls her broker, and asks to modify the trading plan to halt her automated stock sales.
The defense evaporates instantly.
Instantly?
Yes. The moment you modify a plan while in possession of MNPI, you lose the safe harbor completely. Legally, the SEC treats modifying an existing plan the exact same as adopting a brand new plan. It triggers the entire cooling off period all over again.
Wow. Let's go back to Fiona the fiduciary. Fiona knows about a secret, unannounced merger because of her transfer agent duties. Fiona is highly ethical. She doesn't trade. But Fiona talks in her sleep.
Uh-oh.
Her husband is lying in bed, hears her mumble specific details about the merger, and the next morning he goes out and buys short-term call options on the target company. Is the husband guilty of insider trading? He doesn't work for the company, and he didn't steal the files.
He is absolutely guilty, and he will be prosecuted under the misappropriation theory.
Okay, break that down.
Classical insider trading is when a corporate insider breaches their fiduciary duty to their own shareholders. But the misappropriation theory expanded the net. It states that insider trading occurs when someone breaches a duty of trust and confidence to the source of the information. And under SEC rules, certain relationships carry a presumed duty of trust, specifically spouses, parents, children, and siblings. He misappropriated his wife's confidential information for personal gain.
Wait, so he goes down for it because she talks in her sleep. This sounds like a compliance nightmare for large firms. If you have an investment banking division structuring secret mergers on the 40th floor and a retail trading desk executing orders on a 10th floor, how do you prevent the information from linking down the elevator shaft?
By legally mandated force. Broker-dealers are required to establish, maintain, and enforce written information barriers. These are rigorous, systemic policies designed to prevent the flow and misuse of MNPI between departments.
And compliance departments use two specific lists to monitor this, which have very different mechanical functions, the watch list and the restricted list. I like to think of the watch list as a one-way mirror and the restricted list as yellow police tape. Break down why that is.
It is a perfect way to visualize the mechanics. The watch list is a one-way mirror because only compliance is looking through it. It is highly confidential. When the investment bankers start working on a secret deal, that company goes on the watch list. Normal trading at the firm continues as usual. Nobody on the trading floor knows the stock is being monitored. Compliance is simply sitting behind the glass, watching the firm's trading data to see if anyone suddenly starts buying suspiciously timed options.
And the yellow police tape.
The restricted list is the yellow tape. It is published firm-wide. When a deal is about to be announced publicly, or when the firm takes on a specific underwriting role that restricts its ability to trade, the company goes on the restricted list.
So everyone knows about it.
Everyone. It is blasted to every employee. The firm halts all proprietary trading in that security and halts all employee trading. Everyone knows about it, and trading is physically blocked by the firm's systems.
Let's talk about the real-world consequences, because the SEC doesn't just send a strongly worded letter for insider trading.
No, they seek what are called treble damages. The SEC can sue in civil court for a penalty of up to 3 times the profit gain or 3 times the loss avoided by the illegal trade. And they have a 5-year statute of limitations from the date of the trade to bring that action.
And the firms themselves have reporting requirements, right? If compliance, looking through that one-way mirror, actually catches an employee trading on MNPI, they can't just fire them quietly. This introduces the 5-and-10 rule for investment banking firms. Let's spell out exactly how this reporting timeline works.
For firms engaged in investment banking services, if they conduct an internal investigation and determine that an actual violation occurred, like they caught someone red-handed, they must report that violation to FINRA within 5 business days of completing the investigation.
5 business days for a confirmed actual violation. What is the 10?
The 10 is an administrative sweep. Within 10 business days after the end of each calendar quarter, the investment banking firm must submit a report detailing every internal investigation they initiated during that quarter, regardless of the outcome.
Oh, even if they didn't find anything?
Even if they investigated a weird trade, spent a month on it, and determined the employee did absolutely nothing wrong, the fact that an investigation was initiated must be reported on that 10-day quarterly report.
5 days for violations found. 10 days post-quarter for investigations initiated. Got it. Let's shift into our final major topic area, playing the market. We've talked about retail fraud and institutional secrets, but what happens when the corporation itself interacts with the open market? We need our third character.
Enter corporate Carl.
Carl is the CEO of a mid-sized tech company, and he is pathologically obsessed with his company's stock price.
Yeah.
He checks the ticker 30 times a day. Carl wants to create some buzz. He wants the market to think his stock is highly liquid and in massive demand. So he decides to engage in market manipulation. I want to look at the mechanics of two terms that sound similar but are executed very differently. Wash trades versus matched orders.
Both are designed to paint a false picture on the consolidated tape, but the mechanism is different. A wash trade is a solo act. Carl has 2 different brokerage accounts. He buys 10,000 shares in account A and simultaneously sells 10,000 shares from account B. The trade hits the public tape. The market sees 10,000 shares of volume and thinks, wow, there's action here. But there was no actual change in beneficial ownership. Carl just moved the shares from his left pocket to his right pocket.
Okay, wash trade is solo. What is a matched order?
A matched order requires coordination. Carl calls up a wealthy friend and says, at exactly 2.00 p.m., I am going to place a limit sell order for 50,000 shares at $50. I need you to place a limit buy order for 50,000 shares at $50 at that exact same millisecond.
Oh, I see.
They prearrange the trade to guarantee they cross against each other. It artificially inflates volume and anchors the price, tricking the algorithms and retail investors watching the tape.
So Carl tries that, gets caught, and gets fined. Now he decides to try something legal to boost the stock. He's going to issue a special dividend. But he can't just tweet about it the night before. There are rigid communication rules, specifically the 10-day rule for corporate actions.
Yes, if an issuer is declaring a dividend, a stock split, or a rights offering, they must notify FINRA at least 10 days before the record date.
I want to break down the why here. Why does FINRA need 10 days notice before the record date? What is the actual mechanical reason?
It all comes down to the mechanics of trade settlement. We currently operate in a T+1 settlement environment, meaning a trade settles one business day after it is executed.
Right.
Because of T+1, the ex-dividend date, the day the stock begins trading without the value of the dividend attached, is usually the exact same day as the record date.
Let me make sure I have this straight. If I buy the stock on the ex-dividend date, my trade settles the next day, which is the day after the record date. So I'm not on the company's books on the record date, meaning I don't get the dividend.
Exactly. The X date is the crucial dividing line for market pricing. Femeron needs those 10 days of advance notice so they can adjust pricing systems, notify all the broker dealers, and ensure that anyone buying the stock on or after the X date clearly understands they're paying a lower price because they are not entitled to the dividend.
Oh, okay.
If Carl springs a surprise dividend on the market, the pricing algorithms would be blind, trades would settle to the wrong parties, and it would cause a systemic cascade of failed settlements.
10 days before the record date to give the plumbing time to adjust. Okay, let's look at one final scenario for Carl, the CEO. He looks at his stock price and decides it's fundamentally undervalued. He has a ton of cash on the balance sheet, so he wants the company to buy back its own stock in the open market.
Which is legal, but highly dangerous from a regulatory standpoint. Buying your own stocks naturally creates upward pressure on the price. If you do it aggressively, you cross the line into market manipulation. To protect issuers who want to do this legitimately, the SEC created a containment field known as Rule 10b-18, the Issuer Buyback Safe Harbor.
Safe harbor meaning if Carl stays perfectly inside this containment field, the SEC promises not to sue him for market manipulation based on those buybacks.
Correct. It is a non-exclusive safe harbor. To get that protection, Carl must neutralize the four vectors of market impact. He has to follow four daily conditions perfectly. Walk us through the four vectors.
Vector one is manner. The issuer must use a single broker-dealer per day to execute the buybacks. You cannot spread your orders across five different brokers to create the illusion of widespread market demand.
Okay, manner is one broker.
Vector two is timing. You cannot buy at the opening bell, and you cannot buy in the last 10 minutes of regular trading.
Wait, why the last 10 minutes? Why does the SEC care about 3.55 p.m.?
Because the closing price is the universal benchmark. It is the reference point for mutual fund net asset valuations, margin calls, and index pricing. The SEC refuses to let Carl artificially pump the closing price to make his daily chart look better.
Wow, okay. That makes sense.
Vector three is price. Carl cannot pay a price higher than the highest independent bid or the last independent transaction price. He can absorb existing supply, but he cannot actively bid the price upward and lead the market higher.
Okay, so manner, timing, price.
And vector four is volume. Daily purchases are strictly capped at 25% of the stock's average daily trading volume, or ABTV, calculated over the prior 4 weeks. He cannot become the entire market.
Manner, timing, price, volume. But let me push you on that volume limit. What if Carl finds an institutional investor who wants to dump a massive position all at once? It would be highly efficient for the company to just buy it all in one swoop, but it would completely shatter that 25% volume cap.
This is exactly where the exam will try to trap you. There is a specific block exception built into the safe harbor. Once a week, Carl can execute one massive block purchase that exceeds the 25% volume cap.
Okay, so if Carl uses the block exception on a Wednesday to buy 1 million shares, does that waive the other three rules? Like, can he buy that block in the last 10 minutes of the day or pay whatever price he wants?
Absolutely not, and that is the trap. The block exception only waives the volume rule. It is not a blank check. Every other vector, manner, timing, price still strictly applies to that block trade. You still have to use the same single broker, you still cannot execute it at the close, and you still cannot pay above the highest independent bid.
Only the volume rule is waived. And what happens if Carl makes a tiny mistake? Let's say his broker accidentally buys 100 shares at 3:55 p.m., violating the timing rule. Does he just lose the safe harbor protection for those specific 100 shares?
No, the containment field collapses entirely. He loses the safe harbor for all of his trades that entire day. The protection is an all-or-nothing daily status. Now, breaking a condition doesn't automatically mean he is guilty of manipulation, but it means he loses the automatic shield, he is out in the cold, and would have to defend his trading data in court.
The mechanics of that are fascinating.
Okay.
All right, we have covered a massive amount of regulatory ground. It is time for the rapid-fire recap. I am going to tee up the most highly testable numbers and thresholds from today's deep dive, and you knock them down. High energy. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Maximum criminal penalties for an individual willful violation of the Exchange Act.
The 520 rule, $5 million maximum fine, up to 20 years in prison.
Maximum entity fine.
$25 million.
Civil penalty for insider trading.
Treble damages, up to 3 times the profit gained or loss avoided.
To engage in an outside business activity or a private securities transaction, what must the rep provide?
Prior written notice. Always prior, always written.
How long is the grandfather window if a new hire brings outside brokerage accounts to a new firm?
30 calendar days to get written consent and notify the executing firm.
Corporate action notice for declaring a dividend.
At least 10 days before the record date.
And finally, investment banking reporting deadlines for internal investigations.
5 business days for an actual violation found. 10 business days post-quarter to report all investigations initiated.
Boom. We have navigated the muddy waters of human ethics and regulatory enforcement. But before we sign off, I want to leave everyone with a final, slightly terrifying thought that builds on exactly why FINRA keeps their commercial honor rule so vaguely defined.
Okay, let's hear it.
We talked extensively today about how being aware of inside information is enough to trigger liability for a human being. But think about the world we're entering right now. As massive institutional firms increasingly use AI and machine learning algorithms to execute high-frequency trades, what happens if a black box AI detects a microscopic market pattern that practically guarantees a secret merger is happening?
Yeah.
The AI executes a massive, highly profitable trade before the news breaks.
Yeah.
No human representative ever spoke to an insider. No duty of trust was breached by a person. But the firm just profited wildly on what is effectively perfectly simulated material non-public information. Will FINRA one day use that broad commercial honor standard to punish firms for what their AI figures out? Where exactly does the regulatory line between brilliant data analysis and synthetic insider trading get drawn?
That is the frontier regulators are facing right now. The rules were written for human psychology, but they are absolutely going to have to adapt to algorithmic logic.
Synthetic insider trading. Keep that in the back of your mind as you keep studying. Remember, mastering this material isn't just about memorizing rules. It's about understanding the underlying mechanism of the market. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Keep digging into the concepts, trust your preparation, and you're going to crush the Series 24. Thanks for diving deep with us today.